Hello and welcome to this podcast from Blackwell Online. My name is George Miller, and my guest today is Eamon Duffy, who's Professor of the History of Christianity at Cambridge University. Eamon is a leading historian of the English Reformation, perhaps best known for his book, The Stripping of the Altars, first published almost 20 years ago. The book is an investigation into what the people in the parishes of England and Wales really felt during the religious upheavals of the 15th and 16th centuries. A few years ago, Eamon broadcast a series of talks on BBC Radio 4 entitled 10 Popes Who Shook the World, and it is the book of that series which is the subject of this interview. His popes range from St. Peter to John Paul II, and along the way take in reforming popes and reactionaries, and sometimes complex men who combine both instincts, facing the challenges of establishing and shaping the Church's role in an ever-changing world. Given that he had over 260 papal candidates to choose from, I began by asking Eamon how hard it had been to boil it down to a list of just 10.
It was fairly arbitrary. Some of the more recent ones, I felt I couldn't do 10 talks about popes, for example, without tackling the whole issue of Pius XII and the Jews. I felt that I had to say something about John Paul II, because he only very recently died. I thought I ought to start with St. Peter. I thought I had to put in Gregory the Great, because you could argue he was the greatest pope ever. After that, it was really fairly arbitrary. It was a matter of deciding, really, on popes whom one could hang a theme round. So, you know, Gregory the Seventh is conflict between church and state. Paul the Third suggested himself because the Catholic Church faced the Reformation in his pontificate and had to choose between a repressive response and internal reform, and he really opted for both. So, you know, he's the Pope who calls the Council of Trent. He's also the Pope who founds the Roman Inquisition. And I thought, you know, exploring that kind of paradox, and the same way with Innocent III, he's a Pope, the most powerful pope of the Middle Ages, but he's also the man who legitimates the charismatic figures of Francis and Dominic, and, if you like, emotion and intellect incarnate in their religious orders. So the idea that power rather than simply being about itself in his hands actually enables these very charismatic individuals to innovate. So I was looking for themes, figures, popes who would encapsulate big themes.
And although the lineage is traditionally traced all the way back to St. Peter, when is the name Pope first used? When is it first used as a self-description?
The name Pope is used about a lot of bishops in the first three or four centuries. So the Bishop of Carthage is called the Pope, and the head of the Coptic Church, even today, is called Pope. It gets confined to the popes of Rome about 500 years into the Christian era. So after that, fewer references to other bishops as Pope. I mean, it just means father.
I mean, I think one of the fascinating things to see in the book is that the role is far from immutable. It has changed and adapted over the millennia. And things like papal infallibility, which I thought probably went a very long way back, in fact, is of relatively recent date.
Yes, even the word, I mean, the notion of papal infallibility is really a product of debates in the 14th century. And it was originally coined, I mean, I don't go into this because I didn't discuss John the 22nd, who's the key figure here, Franciscan Pope, who was very anxious to prevent popes going back on things that their predecessors had permitted, and coined the idea of infallibility to restrict papal action, to say the popes can't just chop and change, they must stick by previous decisions, because those decisions are infallible. So, paradoxically, a notion that in modern times has been seen as giving the Pope a blank check to say what he likes was originally devised precisely to prevent popes doing that.
And I suppose if there is a single running theme through the book, it is this notion of how the papacy responds to the external world and to what extent it seeks
and that's what I, yeah, that's what I tried to highlight in the little introduction that I wrote, that, and to ask the question, is this just, you know, an incredibly opportunistic, adaptable institution that has survived by in a chameleon-like way, or is there a thread that one can pull through? And the papacy's own self-awareness, which emerges very, very early, you know, by the 3rd century, the popes are seeing themselves as lineal descendants of Peter. And you could argue, in fact, that even by the late 2nd century, when you begin to get the first lists of popes, which are in a sense artificial creations, because the early history of the papacy is totally shrouded in obscurity. And the overwhelming likelihood is that the church in Rome was a sort of confederation of churches governed by their own presbyters, and that the pedigree line of popes, those names, Linus, Cletus, Clement, Sixtus, Cornelius, for relationships with other churches, the guys who wrote the letters, and they get turned in retrospectively to a succession, because there probably wasn't a monarchic bishop in Rome till the mid-second century.
And you see the Catholic Church having to define itself against Eastern Christendom, and then later against the rise of stronger and stronger secular states.
To begin with, it's not defining itself against Eastern Christendom, because Christendom is united for the first millennium. There are individual local schisms and so on, and conflicts over doctrine, but the popes see themselves as part of a universal church that's East and West. But they're very quickly defining themselves over against challenges to orthodoxy, against heresy. I mean, episcopacy itself emerges as a part of the mechanism by which you decide what the true doctrine is. It's the doctrine that this guy teaches. You locate the stability of Christian teaching in a succession of orthodox teachers, the bishops. And so you say to somebody, I don't care how smart you are, I don't care how plausible your doctrine is, if it doesn't agree with what these guys say, then it's new and therefore untrue. So episcopacy emerges as a way of defining the integrity of the community and of the Christian message. And the papacy very quickly sees itself as having a unique function there. And that's very widely conceded, even, you know, by the Eastern churches when they begin to feel that the popes are getting above themselves. They nevertheless, by and large, for the first 1,000 years, accept that Rome has never made a fundamental error in doctrine.
Now, am I correct in seeing Paul III as a truly pivotal pope? You describe him as coming into office as the last of the partying popes, and then, my goodness, by the time he goes out, it does seem as though the world has changed, and he has been an agent for that change in terms of, you know, the beginning of the Inquisition, the Counter-Reformation, the Index, the Jesuits. I mean, it does seem to me that he did truly shake the world in every sense.
Yeah, and he's also, you know, he's an extraordinarily complex figure. You could take him as an emblem of everything that we think was, you know, worst about the Renaissance papacy. Nepotism, the fact that he had a mistress, though not while he was pope. You know, that he made his grandchildren cardinals. He's very worldly, all of that. So the sort of thing you associate with the Borgias. And his sister was Alexander VI, the Borgia Pope's mistress. That's how he gets to be Pope. And yet, he's the man who makes St. John Fisher a cardinal. He's the man who makes Reginald Poole a cardinal. Gasparo Contarini, these great reforming figures. He's the Pope who at last grasps the nettle and convenes a council. The popes were afraid to call a council because the track record of conflict between council and pope had been very bad over the preceding century. So they're nervous about calling a council, that it'll erode their authority, that the council will turn on the papacy itself and try to reform it in ways that the papacy doesn't want. But he actually does call a council, and that council is the body that really maps out a new kind of austere, highly organized, highly centralized Catholicism with established standards of orthodoxy, established ways of shaping the clergy, the invention of seminaries, all of that. So he straddles the corruption of the Renaissance, corruption in inverted commas, because there was more to be said for the Renaissance papacy than corruption. I mean, it's the great patron of the arts. And, you know, he's the last great papal patron of Michelangelo. Michelangelo does his greatest work for him. So the church, as a great force in culture as well as in politics and religion, he stands for all that. But he's also the source of this ferocious heresy-hunting aspect of Catholicism that's in some way still with us in some forms. By establishing the Roman Inquisition, by establishing the Index of Prohibited Books, by making the Holy Office the most powerful of the bodies within the Curia. And after him come a series of inquisitor popes, people like Paul IV and Sixtus V, Pius V, you know, who's been canonized, the man who excommunicated Queen Elizabeth and who was an inquisitor as well. So he gathers into himself all these contradictory and complex strands in early modern Catholicism.
You mentioned earlier, Eamon, that you felt you had to include Pius XII, and he is clearly still a highly contentious figure. You describe the literature on him as a never-expanding minefield.
Yeah.
It seemed to me that he wasn't so much a pope that shook the world as a pope who, while the world was shaking, sort of turned his back on it or turned his eyes away from it. Is that fair?
Yes, I try to avoid simply saying that because, you know, he's a pope who confronts the most terrible war that has ever been and confronts these two appalling tyrannies under Stalin and Hitler and had to, you know, decide how to respond. And what I wanted to bring out was that his response was conditioned by the way in which the papacy over the previous 40 years had accustomed itself to dealing with the modern state. There's a sense in which everything about his policies and strategies he inherited from the two preceding popes, from Benedict XV and Pius XI. You know, his tragedy was that the attempt to deal with tyranny by diplomatic negotiation. Just when you're confronted with Hitler, he, in a way, he's the sort of ecclesiastical equivalent of Chamberlain and fails for much the same reason that diplomatic channels and rational political negotiation are simply inadequate in the face of crazed tyranny. And he never seemed to grasp that was not a way that you could proceed. He was all the time trying to preserve negotiating place for the church. Although he knew Hitler wouldn't honor agreements, he thought that having the agreements meant you had at least something you could say, look, you have broken this agreement, that it gave you some shred of bargaining power. He was also, of course, convinced that communism was at least as great a threat to the church and to humanity as Nazism was. He didn't have as much information about what was going on under Stalin, but he had a good idea. And he felt paralyzed by the Allies' demand that he ignore the tyrannical aspects of the Soviet regime because they were the Soviet regime was our ally against Hitler. Mm. And he felt that to do that would be to sell the church out to communism, which he thought was a much more terrible enemy of Christianity. At least Nazism did not say explicitly that it was going to destroy Christianity, whereas Bolshevism, Stalinism, did say that explicitly. The churches were open in Germany. They were closed in the Soviet Union. And for a religious leader, that had to count. So I wanted to bring out the reality of his dilemmas, but I also wanted to come clean that my own feeling was that he was a rather frozen human being. The dilemmas were real. He certainly was no more of an anti-Semite than most of the civilized people of his own time were. There was a low-level anti-Semitism that was universal. Mm-hmm. You find it in T.S. Eliot as well as the Pope. And he certainly shared a sort of civilized distaste towards the Jews that we now find appalling, but was so much part of the background that you wouldn't have noticed it in those days. But I don't think that his rather constipated response to the Holocaust was down to anti-Semitism. It was down to the sort of motives I discussed, a fear that he would unleash worse by denunciation. I didn't have time to explore this in the book, but that's all complicated by the fact that after the war, he did denounce communist atrocities in Iron Curtain countries, even though that might precipitate reprisals. So the defense that he feared reprisals is weakened by his subsequent behavior in denouncing communism and excommunicating all communists. Everybody who joined the Communist Party in Italy, he excommunicated them. So there is an inconsistency there that I think his defenders need to address. The subtext of that piece is the rather worrying moves towards beatifying him, which would seem to me to be folly, apart from anything else.
The contrast between Pius XII and John Paul II probably couldn't be greater. And you call, in fact, John Paul II the greatest man to occupy the chair of Peter for centuries. And I wondered, as his papacy retreats in memory, what do you think the achievements of it, the lasting achievements of it are?
I think his greatest achievement was the role he played in the liberation of Poland. That is, I think his greatest achievement was political. That's why I was sort of moving towards the formulation that he was a great man, but not necessarily a great pope. And that was, again, in a way, the subtext of that talk, that I suppose his second great achievement was his death, the nobility of his death. I allude to this in the piece, that you could argue that it was a very bad thing for him to hold on to the papacy while he was dying, because, you know, who was minding the shop? He was so ill for so long that the business of the church was certainly in other people's hands, and he was not in control of it. And there was a pretense that, you know, the Pope was physically very frail, but his mind was clear. Sometimes it wasn't, sometimes it wasn't. I met him on a day when it wasn't. So you could argue that, you know, he should have resigned. But it seemed to me all those arguments were silenced by the magnificence of his death. You know, this painfully sick man, at the end stricken dumb, but going on with it, and in a sort of walk to Calvary. And it was just, it seemed to me, incredibly dignified and inspiring. Inspiring not just for the old and the dying, but of, you know, somebody who felt this was a burden that had been laid on him that he didn't have the right to lay down, and that he would carry absolutely to the last ounce of his strength. And I thought, just in human terms, that was titanic. So I think his human greatness, his talents, his story, as a man who lived under Nazi tyranny, under Soviet tyranny, who helped to set his people free, who became the first non-Italian pope for centuries, who traveled the world, a man that was seen by more human beings than any other figure in human history. It's just an awesome story. But I, in a sense, so enormous was his personality that he created enormous expectations of the papacy and of all subsequent holders. I mean, how do you live up to that? How most popes are not titanic heroes. They don't have his stamina. They don't have his life experience. They don't have his role in the history of the world. So it's a case, I think, of a man who was too big for the job, almost.
I mean, it's clear that the job description, so to speak, has changed over the 2,000 years that you survey. And your book introduced me to the rather nice adjective papabile, which I presume means possessing the qualities suitable for a pope.
That's right.
And I wondered what you thought made a candidate papabile in the 21st century, following on from John Paul II.
Oh, golly. Well, I mean, that's a guessing game, isn't it? I think anybody who wants to be, who is likely to become pope has to be a linguist, has to be intelligent and healthy, and has to have a profile that brings them into contact with a lot of cardinals. Over and beyond, I mean, those, if you like, are qualifications for being a pope. I think the idea of a pope who didn't, for example, speak English and Spanish and Italian would be very difficult to defend, because those are the languages of the church. And the last pope was elected because he was the best known of the cardinals. And I think, in to some extent, because of his very high profile in the funeral and the management of the church after the death of John Paul II, he was virtually the only cardinal that all the other cardinals knew. So I think that's a very important thing. But beyond that, what makes a man papabile depends on what you think the papacy is for. So if you take a gloomy view of the world and of the state of the church, you want a strong pope who will exert discipline and maintain orthodoxy, you'll go for one kind of candidate. If you think that the church needs to de-Europeanize itself, de-Westernize itself, and go where its strengths are in Asia and Africa, then that would dictate a different kind of pope. Do you want an administrator or a pastor? Do you want somebody who is going to involve the bishops of the world more in real decision-making, or do you want a strong disciplinarian? So the qualifications will vary according to what your recipe for the future of the church is.
And of course, then the complexion of the electorate is crucial, isn't it? The views of the cardinals who are making that decision. And I presume they are preponderantly European.
They are, and central administration in Rome has become increasingly Italian under this pope. This pope is very focused on Europe, preoccupied by it intellectually, very concerned about the loss of a sense of Christian identity in Europe. So I think that's where his attention has been focused and where his interest has been engaged. I also think that under the last two pontificates, the cardinals have been increasingly cautious and conservative men. Paul VI made some very, very imaginative cardinalatial appointments. There have been some very strong people made cardinals, but the church is in a period in which it's, you know, maintaining its borders very carefully. And I think that will help to determine the outcome of the next election as well. But papal elections often surprise.
Eamon Duffy. 10 Popes Who Shook the World is published by Yale University Press and is out this October in hardback. You can find out more about 10 Popes, as well as several million other titles, by visiting blackwell.co.uk. You'll also find a podcast archive there with over 150 author interviews by clicking the podcast tab on the home page. If you've enjoyed this podcast, you may also be interested in the previous conversation I had with Eamon Duffy about his book The Fires of Faith, which presents a new view of Catholic England under Mary Tudor. You'll find that under the History category on the podcast homepage. That's all for this edition of the Blackwell Online podcast, but I hope you'll join me again soon for another programme. Until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.